exotic thing. This is my first paper that has that mentions black holes and actually means it. So it's a little more theoretical than what I used to be doing. But I'll talking about renormalization of entanglement entropy in relationship to gravitational physics. This is work just out hot off the archive with Josh Cooperman, a student at UC Davis who's going to be going to Nijmegen, or however you pronounce that, for a postdoc. Okay, so introduction. So if you go to a person on the street and you say to them, E equals mc squared, this is probably one of the few formulas that they will have heard of, okay? And if you ask them, what does it mean or what is it associated with, you'll probably get the answer Einstein. That's the most common answer you'll probably get. And if they know some physics, you might, if you're lucky, get the answer atomic bomb, right? Okay. So there's another almost as famous to physicists formula, which is the formula for the entropy of a black hole. Everybody knows this formula, okay? It's a quarter the area in fundamental units, basically. But you can really ask the question about whether we physicists understand this formula any better than the layperson understands this formula. We all sort of know the formula. Everybody agrees that it's right. But it's not at all clear what it actually means, okay? So let me just remind a few basic facts about black hole thermodynamics, and I'll be talking about one particular interpretation of what that formula might mean. So this is to set the stage. So in black hole thermodynamics, we have in a black hole, there's a special place, the horizon, the space-time surface, and any time slice that goes through the horizon, it divides the system into two parts, outside the horizon and inside. And there's a class of observers, including the observers that are very far away from the black hole, that cannot see anything inside the horizon. So it's natural to divide the states of the system into the states that correspond to the inside and the outside. So a general state is written as some combination like this. Okay, and then if we can only do observations on the outside, it's natural to trace over the states on the inside and define a density matrix that's associated with the region A outside. And basically, this density matrix describes all the quantum measurements you can do outside the black hole. Okay, and the whole subject of black hole thermodynamics boils down to the statement that if A is the quantum field theory outside a black hole horizon, then this density matrix looks thermal. So to an outside observer, at least a certain class of observers, the quantum fields look like they're in a thermal state. That's why black holes are thermal. Okay. So this particular way of thinking about the thermality of black holes led to a big idea, which I'm now going to describe. And really, the sort of visionary in this was Sorkin, who said, basically, what I'm going to tell you now back in 1983. so what Sorkin basically said is that, well, okay, if this density matrix that describes the quantum fields outside the black hole, if it's thermal, then if there's some sort of entropy associated with the black hole, it's natural for that to just be the von Neumann entropy of this density matrix, okay? So let's think about that possibility. That has some nice properties. One is that it actually doesn't matter if the black hole is in a pure state. It doesn't matter whether you trace over the inside of the black hole or the outside of the black hole. This is a basic property of entanglement entropy in pure states. Okay? And so he asked the question whether this could be associated with the black hole entropy. Then he went on to notice that, in fact, this entanglement entropy is UV divergent and proportional to the area. And the reason that it's UV divergent is because even in the vacuum state, in quantum field theory, all the modes of arbitrary wavelengths are entangled across the horizon. So basically, the ground state of quantum field theory, we're all familiar with the fact that free quantum field theory is just a bunch of coupled harmonic oscillators. The way we uncouple them is we look at the K modes, right, the spatial momentum modes. Each spatial momentum mode is an independent harmonic oscillator that's in the ground state. But a K mode correlates the spatial oscillators at, you know, at arbitrary wavelengths. And so they're arbitrarily high large k's, and so you get a UV divergence. And he figured out that it was actually proportional to the area, okay? Well, this is actually, the fact that the black hole entropy is proportional to the area was supposed to be one of the most mysterious things about it, the fact that, maybe it was somehow connected with holography. But here, you see that it's just some basic thing about free quantum field theory, actually. The entanglement entropy has this property. And if you were just were so brave as to say, well, yeah, and I should actually, I should cut it off at the Planck scale, because that's sort of when space-time ends, that's when my cutoff is, then I, in fact, get that the entropy is the right order of magnitude to be the black hole entropy. Okay. Of course, I have not explained the factor of 1/4, right? All right? So this is all what Sorkin said and various other people developed, these kinds of ideas. The next big step in this story comes with Susskind and Ugglum, and also Jacobson made some similar statements, although not, I think, as detailed. Susskind and Ugglum pointed out that if we look at this famous formula that we're all trying to figure out what on earth it means, it's actually not just, if we interpret this as entanglement entropy, then it's UV divergent, but the right-hand side is also UV divergent, because in a quantum theory, the Planck scale gets quantum corrections that are UV divergent, okay? So actually, this UV divergence is actually, it's on both sides of this equation, right? And so then they ask the natural question, well, maybe they match. Maybe it's the UV divergences of this match the UV divergences of this. So if we write this UV divergent formula, there was this coefficient C in the quadratic divergence in the area term here. There's a coefficient C prime in the quadratic divergence of M Planck. Maybe these are related by this famous factor of 1/4, okay? And one interesting thing about this is a very precise conjecture, actually. You can check this in flat spacetime. Once you've had, you know, this of course all came from thinking about black holes, but this entanglement entropy I can compute for any surface in flat spacetime, and this renormalization of M Planck, of course, I could do in flat spacetime as well, okay? So it leads to this conjecture, okay? Now, it must have been the same day as the Susskind and Ugglum paper appeared on the archive, plus two archive numbers later, there was a paper, very nice paper by Callan and Wilczek, which is relevant for this story. And they pointed out in this paper that the entanglement entropy, in fact, is a geometrical object and has, in fact, gave a very beautiful geometrical formula for it. So I'm going to explain that. So if we start off before we do, you know, at the very beginning, what does the entanglement entropy depend on? We have to specify a time slice, and then we have to specify an entangling surface that divides it into two parts. So that's sort of geometrical so far. But then we have to specify a state on this time slice, which is not a priori a geometrical thing, right? It's a state, okay? But we can make this setup geometrical by looking at states that are given by a path integral. So this is a very common thing that we do. The reason we're able to do quantum field theory with path integrals is because we can write the vacuum state as a path integral, right? And we can write a somewhat more general class of states by just integrating over field configurations that end on the slice at a given configuration, little phi. So capital phi are the space-time fields. Little phi are the fields on this surface. And if we integrate over all fields that have the boundary value little phi on this surface, we get the wave function, right? And so we can get different wave functions by choosing, for example, different background metrics in our action. Those metrics don't have to satisfy any equations of motion. They're just some metric that I make up. And choosing the metric is equivalent to choosing the state, okay? So with that setup, the state now is just given by the space-time metric. So the entire entanglement entropy depends only now on the space-time geometry with this entangling surface, which is now just some codimension 2 surface, right? Because there's space and time, and then there's however many dimensions along this thing. So there's some codimension 2 entangling surface, and that's it. And the rest is completely geometrical. Okay? All right. And then they wrote down a very beautiful formula for it, okay? And I'll derive this in a second, but first I just want to say what the formula is. The formula is you take this W right here is just the effective action for the theory in this gravitational, in this background metric, okay? And delta right here is a deficit angle that we introduce in this codimension 2 space at the entangling surface. And you're supposed to take the limit as the deficit angle goes to zero of some derivative, essentially, of W, okay? So don't worry about where this came from for now, but just say for a second that we believe this formula, okay? If you believe this formula, it would seem that, it would immediately prove the Susskind-Ugglum conjecture, right? Because this thing right here, this effective action has some UV divergences in it. Great, fine. It has whatever UV divergences it has. But then renormalizing those UV divergences gives you a finite W, and then doing this thing to W must give you a finite entanglement entropy. So renormalizing the gravitational effective action, according to this formula, should renormalize the entanglement entropy, okay? So this whole thing should have been settled in 1994, whatever. Okay? All right? Okay, but there are some caveats here. Notice that this formula right here actually only makes sense for spacetimes that have a boost or rotation symmetry around the entangling surface. Basically, saying that I'm introducing a deficit angle, and so what do I mean by this? First of all, let me say what I mean by this. So in Minkowski space, it means here's the entangling surface, and there's some kind of boost symmetry that leaves this thing invariant. So for GR people, this is a bifurcate killing horizon, okay? And in Euclidean space, if you Euclideanize this, this just turns into a simple rotation symmetry around the transverse direction. And introducing a deficit angle, clearly this picture, it's clearer what's going on. Introducing a deficit angle just means cutting out a piece of this space. But that's only uniquely defined if there is a rotation symmetry like this, right? So this formula only makes sense for this kind of symmetry. But at least for this kind of symmetry, it would seem that it completely settles the question. Okay? Yeah? Yes. Right. Right. Well, you could. I think you could use dimensional regularization in at least in sufficiently simple backgrounds. Like in flat space, I think you could. But yes, but you bring up a very important point, is that this only makes sense if there is some kind of generally covariant cutoff. So what I'm trying to argue is that there's a geometrization of this thing. You can basically formulate the entanglement entropy as a geometrical quantity, and then if you regularize it in a covariant way, for example, you could use Pauli VRs. There are heat kernel methods. There are various things that you could do. Okay, but yeah, okay. I'm going to tell you now what I'm going to do in this talk. So what I've said up till now is background. It's things that are there in the literature as of, say, 1996, and it looks like things are, certainly look to me like the subject was, there was not very much to do, and then actually Rob Myers was very encouraged me to write up some of these results, okay? So I'm going to do the following thing. First of all, I'm going to derive this magical formula of Callan and Wilczek. They justified it by using this replica trick, which is some kind of analytic continuation from the integers to the reals, which it's questionable, to say the least. But you can derive it without that. I'm going to show that. I'm going to argue, and I'm arguing probably not with you, but I'm arguing with the people who worked on this subject for a long time, I finally understood that we did something new when I got all sorts of emails telling me I was completely wrong, which was a huge relief because I thought that we were just saying things that everybody knew. So I'm going to be having a little two-slide argument with those people that you get to watch, so you can understand, I think, a little bit about what these people are thinking. At least I think I understand better what they're thinking. Okay, and then the key technical result is going to be, I'm going to show that you actually, in order to really establish this formula, you have to show that UV divergences that are localized on the entangling surface don't contribute to the entanglement entropy. So that's a technical thing that I'll explain. I'm going to point out that the subleading UV divergent terms in the entanglement entropy depend on the state, and that's something that I think hasn't been appreciated in the literature. And then we want to check that even if we include some of these subleading UV divergent pieces, the entanglement entropy for a black hole geometry continues to agree with the black hole entropy. And this is the subleading terms in the black hole entropy are given by a very beautiful formula by Wald. So we want to check that this Wald entropy agrees with the entanglement entropy. Okay? And I'll speculate at the end. This is somewhat technical stuff, but I'll give a few speculations at the end about what is the bigger meaning of all of this. Okay? Okay, but for right now, I think it's some beautiful field theory. What it really means, we'll speculate. Okay, so here is how do we prove the Kalin-Wilczek formula. So we write a path integral expression for this density matrix. So basically what it means is we just integrate, here I'm going to Euclidean space, we integrate over the action, but we have choose different boundary values for the fields when we approach A from above and below, and doing that path integral gives us the matrix elements of the density matrix. It's clear that this is right because if we set these things equal and integrate over them, we're just doing the full path integral, right? So this is clearly the right density matrix, okay? Now, suppose we have this rotation invariance around the entangling surface. In that case, what we can do is we can imagine evolving this time slice using angle as a time. So we can just think of some kind of Hamiltonian evolution where we take the slice, bump, 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 and rotate it all the way around via Hamiltonian evolution. And because of the rotation invariance, the Hamiltonian for that, just the rotation generator, is a nice local operator, right? It is an integral over this slice of a local operator, to be precise, okay? And the density matrix is literally just do a 2 pi rotation, okay? Which is literally just e to the minus 2 pi times the rotation generator, okay? So for the rotational case, this rho is a very simple thing. And the point is, this is something I know how to take the log of. I don't know how to take the log of very many operators, but e to an operator is something I do know how to take the log of, right? So now, when you can see that if I allow rho to be not normalized to unity, then to find the entanglement entropy, you can expand rho to the n around n equals 1. This plus 1 term takes care of the normalization. And so this leads directly to the Kalin-Wilczek formula because in the normal, the standard derivation, I somehow continue this from integer n. But here I don't need to do that because this rho to the n makes perfect sense even for non-integer n, right? It's just equal to e to the minus 2 pi nk. And this path integral with this kind of an action right here is exactly equivalent to not going all the way around, but going down, going around up to an angle delta given by 2 pi 1 minus n. Okay? So so for the rotation invariant spacetimes, which is the only case where it makes sense, this is a derivation. So this formula is just true. Okay? Now, let's think about what about the UV divergences in the Kalin-Wilczek formula? Okay? The entanglement entropy is UV divergent because these modes, these arbitrarily high energy or short wavelength modes, are entangled across the boundary, right? And we also know that if we in a pure state, if we trace over the inside versus the outside, we trace over either side, we get the same entanglement entropy. So the fact that it's local and that it's the same on both sides tells us that it has to be some kind of UV divergent term localized on the boundary, okay? And so in four dimensions, for example, the entanglement entropy has to be an integral over the 2D entangling surface, and then you can just write down all the possible geometrical invariants that can be there. So the leading term is quadratically divergent, okay? That's a constant. So this gives us the area term because integrating this gives us the area. But then there are various log terms in two dimensions. And in higher dimensions, there are more things. Okay? All right? And so now what we want to do is we want to regulate all of this. So to regulate this, we need some generally covariant regulator. So for example, Pauli-VRs, Dimreg, something like that. Okay? So now we come to this issue, though, that if we have a space-time like this with a deficit angle cut out, this is exactly equivalent to having a codimension 2 brain that's localized there. So it's a famous thing in general relativity that if you have a codimension 2 brain, if you look at the solutions to that, that actually cuts out a deficit angle, right? And it's very well known that when we have brains, we have brain world scenarios, we have various singular surfaces in space-times, then, and we have quantum fields, then in general, there will be counterterms that are localized on the surface, okay? And so this quantity here, which is the quantity that enters into the Kalin-Wilczek formula, has counterterms that are localized on the entangling surface. It has UV divergences localized on the entangling surface. So it does the entanglement entropy by that formula, okay? Oh, sorry. No, I hear, I'm sorry. Here I'm having this argument with these people that you don't know, okay? So, okay, here's what I'm, sorry. Okay, not with the slide, but the point of the slide. The point of the slide is to argue that we're supposed to keep the counterterms in W, okay? Now that may seem like, if that seems like an obvious thing to you, great, okay? It's supposed to be obvious, but it's not obvious to the people who are arguing this on the next slide. So I'm just going to make, I'm just going to remind you, why is it that we include the counterterms? I mean, the basic point is that here I'm trying to make is that, well, either we believe the Kalin-Wilczek formula or we don't, okay? And if we believe it, if we don't believe it, no, we should stop this talk now. If we believe it, then we should include the counterterm. Okay? And so the entanglement entropy has a counterterm. Another thing is you might say, well, I don't know. I don't like to add just a counterterm to an entropy. What is that? It's supposed to be counting states. What am I doing adding a counterterm? Well, the point is that you know, because this thing is UV divergent, then you know that if you change the cutoff, you also are equivalent to adding a counterterm. So even if you have it, you know, if you have an UV divergence, unless you think there's some real physical significance to your cutoff, you should be able to change the cutoff and get the same answer. And that's equivalent to adding a counterterm. Now, the reason that you might not like to add these counterterms is you might say, well, then I lose the state counting interpretation. For example, entanglement entropy should always be positive because I'm just counting states, ultimately, in a full quantity. But if I'm just adding an arbitrary constant to it, who tells me that that constant has to be positive? Okay, and in fact, we'll see that that's a real issue. Okay, so if I add these counterterms, I'm losing the manifest state counting interpretation. This is true. Okay, however, we will see later that in fact, the renormalized entanglement entropy with the counterterms added is equal to the black hole entropy in every case where we can compare. So we have, it's true that we have lost the manifest state counting interpretation, but true, nonetheless. Okay. And this is my little thing that says that I'm alerts you to the fact that I'm speculating, so that means you're not supposed to yell at me if I say something absurd. Okay. So suppose that somehow, so all of this stuff with counterterms makes a lot of sense if you were to think that for somehow, we don't know exactly how, entanglement entropy is actually a well-defined observable in quantum gravity. It's a very basic quantum mechanical thing.
You guys must be listening. So whoever's listening to this must be listening to this thing dragging on the floor for the last few minutes. I feel sorry for them. I apologize.
So all of this cutoff story makes perfect sense if entanglement entropy really is a well-defined quantity, like, you know, the charge of the electron or something. We're used to those things being UV divergent. We're used to adding counterterms, you know, and the fact that the cutoff dependence cancels is just because there's some fundamental theory where everything makes sense and everything is well defined. So all of this renormalization structure that we'll find for entanglement entropy would be explained if the entanglement entropy was just a well defined number.
There's got to be a better way. Sorry. Okay.
Was a well-defined number in quantum gravity. Okay, and then there would be a very natural interpretation, state counting interpretation, and the counterterms would just be fixed by requiring that the entanglement that they basically count the entanglement of the modes above the, your quantum field theory cutoff. Yeah.
Are you going to claim that it's well-defined for any surface or just for horizons?
I would say that since it's, I would argue that since it's a local thing, these UV divergences are local, there's nothing that really distinguishes a black hole horizon from locally from any other place. Okay? Yeah, but I could define it to be diffeomorphism invariant by saying it's the future of some circle for something like that. I mean, oh, there, I could draw a circle with chalk. I mean, the black hole is a circle with chalk. It's a one kind of state that picks out this horizon. Yeah, yeah, it's a speculation. So you're not allowed to grill me too hard. Okay. I'm just saying that this renormalization structure is reminiscent of the sort of situation where we have a, you know, but yeah, but you should bug Rob about this. Rob has, you know, Rob has a paper that's devoted to this speculation. So, okay? Okay, and then that would say that if we follow this thing to its ultimate limit, yeah, that basically any surface has a finite entanglement entropy whose leading term is a quarter the area in Planck units in quantum gravity. And that would be interesting to know whether that makes sense. But this renormalization structure certainly suggests that. Okay, that's all I'm saying. Yeah.
Quantum gravity is not renormalized in the quantum space. We have an infinite number of subtractions. It's not just
quadratic. Sure, I mean, I'm imagining some complete theory, string theory, for example, you know, some complete theory that would have to be completely finite, completely predictive.
The reason there are counts is you have to subtract because of quadratic division. This introduces this constant, which is troubling.
It's not troubling me, but yeah.
Anyway.
Yeah, no, I mean, so, yeah, I'm just saying that in a complete theory, this should be calculable, and these results, you know, at least are suggestive that this is somehow the answer. All this renormalization business points to this. It's a conjecture. That's why there's this red thing there. Okay? Okay, so, on the other hand, there are various people who... it wasn't clear to me that this is what they're saying before, but I think this is what they're saying. They're saying that, no, you should not add counterterms to the entanglement entropy. What I am talking about is not the entanglement entropy. When I add those counterterms, I have gone off the reservation. I am no longer talking about entanglement entropy, according to these people. Okay? So I think, by consistency, they mean the entanglement entropy. What they mean is just, well, it is just UV divergent. It's just a UV divergent quantity, okay? And it's only defined in the context of some regulator, okay? And so they, on the other hand, somehow these same people very much want to connect this to black hole physics. They're desperately trying to do that. So they want to use some generally covariant regulator. They don't want to use, for example, a lattice cutoff. A lattice cutoff, you truly would have a finite answer for this thing, and you would have a state counting interpretation. Everything would be wonderful. It would be a true entanglement entropy of a true quantum system, but it would not have any connection to black holes, right? What these people want to do is they want to use some generally covariant regulator, okay? And in that case, you also lose the state counting interpretation. Look at all of these any of these things right here. This has negative norm states. Who knows what the state counting interpretation of these are. And in fact, this entanglement entropy is negative in some cases, okay? So then they say, well, I don't really mean this either. So why is it negative? It's negative. It has to do with the fact that if I have this conical singularity, I actually have a singular term there. And what I find is that this thing leads to the fact that this coefficient here is negative in some theories, okay? So if you say that somehow I don't like counterterms because they ruin the state counting interpretation, well, you ruin the state counting interpretation by having a generally covariant regulator. Okay, all right. Then I think I'm going to sort of skip over this next slide. So what I'm trying to say here is that if you really want to get, I'll talk about this if somebody's really interested. If you want to get further into the brains of what these people are thinking. We can think about this example of a curvature term for a scalar. And there, the UV divergent part of the entanglement entropy depends on this xi. And that seems paradoxical because in flat space it should not, but the M Planck squared depends on it in such a way that this thing is still finite. So they want to somehow subtract away the xi dependent part of this, but I don't think there's a generally covariant way to do that. Yeah. What are you asking? Does that make these people happy? Does that?
Not about these people, about the sign.
Sorry?
About the sign.
The sign. Yeah, so what will happen in a lot of theories is that, for example, in theories with the right values of xi, which I forget what they are, but for some values of this curvature term, this c is negative, okay? And so the UV divergent part is negative, and so is the UV divergent part of the Planck scale, by the way. And they match in exactly this way so that the renormalized thing works out right. Okay? Are you asking me, are there cases where the counter term is negative? I think there are.
I was asking just about the interpretation of the counter terms as coming as a contribution to the entropy.
Oh, yeah. But I think that, you see, you know, the point is that in the case where let's say this is negative, that interpretation is not, there's not literally a splitting like there's these states that are below the cutoff and these states that are above the cutoff. If there were, then the UV divergent part would just have a state counting interpretation, right? It's something where you're mistreating the states at high energies in some way, right? You're, like, for example, Pauli VRs, you're literally adding negative norm states, for example, right? And what the counter term then is doing is sort of correcting for that to match onto the correct continuum answer, if you think there is such a thing. So it's not literally, yeah, there's not a literal state counting interpretation.
When you talk about the correct continuum answer, you assume that you have this
problem. So then I'm when I say the correct continuum answer, there's that little red flashing light that's there. I mean, then I'm speculating. You're right. Okay. So that's a question of interpretation. In the end, this renormalization property is a technical result, which is just true. But yes, okay. Here we're sort of arguing about interpretation. Okay. Good. I'm glad you're not totally satisfied. That makes me feel like it's not totally trivial. Let's see, what did I want to say here? Okay, so somehow they would want to redefine the UV divergent part of the entanglement entropy that it's independent of this xi, to avoid this negative counter term, but I don't believe there's any generally covariant way to do that. So I don't think this makes sense. Okay, that's my finishing my argument with various people who are not in this room. Not very fair, but anyway. So now let's just go back to doing field theory, and let's just ask, does this Coleman-Weinberg, Callan-Wilczek, yes, imply Suskind-Uglum? Okay, does Callan-Wilczek imply Suskind-Uglum? And so here's the formula. Okay, we've given a formal path integral derivation of it. So, and the issue we're concerned with is the fact that this thing has UV divergences localized on the singular conical surface, right? And so what do they look like? Well, let's just look what it looks like. So we would have, we would have various bulk terms. I'm looking in 4D here. Actually, all of this works in any dimension. I'm just using 4D for illustration. Then we have the 2D entangling surface. We notice we also have a quadratic divergence, higher order terms, and so on. So the question is, why don't these contribute to the entanglement entropy? Okay. The coefficients of these divergences certainly depend on delta, right? They depend on the geometry near the surface. But what we're going to show is that those divergences are always come in at order delta squared. Okay, so remember delta is the deficit angle, and the entanglement entropy involves only the first derivative of delta, so it does not depend on this. Okay, other quantities would depend on it. So the way we're going to show that is here I've written down an arbitrary rotationally invariant geometry. So r and theta are sort of polar coordinates for the transverse surface, and y are the coordinates along the entangling surface. And I've used some kind of Gaussian normal coordinates here. And notice I've introduced this epsilon beta thing. So theta is an angle that goes from 0 to 2 pi. So if this term in square brackets were not there, this would just be a nice rotationally invariant metric. And so the way I'm going to introduce the deficit angle is I'm going to, a deficit angle is equivalent to a rescaling of theta. But in order to smooth this thing, I want to turn this thing on smoothly. So there's this function beta, which goes from 0 to 1. Okay? And the asymptotic value, this epsilon right here, parameterizes the deficit angle that I have at large distances. So this is a perfectly smooth metric. And so the only kinds of divergences I'm going to get in a smooth metric are bulk divergences, right? I'm not going to get, there's no singular surface, so that's it. And so what I'm going to show then is that I'm going to then take the L goes to zero limit for fixed UV cutoff lambda at linear order in epsilon and just show that there are no localized divergences. Yeah? So, okay, so the L is a UV cutoff. So L is the scale over which this thing rises to 1. So L I'm going to take to 0. When L goes to 0, this becomes a conical singularity. Sorry, was that your question or what was? What is the small parameter in this thing? Yeah, there. Okay, so I'm expanding simultaneously in the UV cutoff. You should think of lambda and L as both being part of the UV cutoff. Okay, I'm going to take the. I'm going to hold the UV cutoff fixed. I'm going to be working at a fixed value of the UV cutoff. Okay, and I'm going to take L goes to zero and look at the order epsilon terms. So the idea is that I'm always working to order epsilon, and I'm going to show that the L goes to zero limit of the Kalin-Wilczek formula makes sense. You're worried about some order of limits question, is that? I mean, I think the right, see, especially if you think about this physically, this lambda could very well be the mass of a heavy particle that I'm integrating out, right? So it's just some big UV scale. I'm eventually going to do physics below this scale right here. And I want to know how the entanglement entropy and the Planck scale depend on this heavy mass, okay? In that case, this would be the only UV regulator in the problem, and I should definitely take this to zero holding this fixed, right? And this is just some parameter that I'm using to take a derivative. So I don't think there's any issue. Okay, anyway. All right, now, and this statement is really only true at order epsilon. So at order epsilon squared, when you look at this L goes to zero limit, you get additional 1 over L divergences localized on the entangling surface, and those precisely signal the need for more counterterms, right? Okay, so, yeah, okay. And now, now that I've smoothed out my metric, the very first thing I do when I actually try to do the proof is that I consider a non-smooth beta. I just look at a step function, okay? Which gives me a discontinuous metric. I say it loud and I say it proud. But what me worry? I don't worry about that. Why? I don't need to worry about it because I'm only interested in putting this thing in at linear order, right? And this is a perfectly well-defined distribution. What does it mean to be a distribution? To be a distribution means it doesn't matter how you take the continuum limit of this thing. So in other words, for a distribution, we would get the same result with a smoothed regulator, okay? In fact, we originally did it with a smooth regulator until we realized we were being idiots, okay? So you can do the proof with a smooth regulator if it makes you more happy, okay? But anyway, this way you get a very simple, the result becomes very transparent because now what you do is you just say, okay, here is my W, and it's just some series of local operators with various UV divergent coefficients. Now what I do is I just expand this thing and find the order epsilon term in this thing, okay? Now remember that epsilon multiplied this beta, right? And what I claim is that the order epsilon term will always be proportional to at least one derivative of beta. The basic reason is that if beta is a constant, I'm just rescaling the theta coordinate, and nothing local can depend on that. So I always will find at least one derivative. But the derivative of beta is just a delta function. That's by this thing right here. And so this just tells me to evaluate the order epsilon term, just evaluates this thing direct, the order epsilon piece of this directly on the entangling surface. And then to see that that delta function doesn't multiply something that diverges, I use the fact that this action has to converge term by term to show that this order epsilon term can have a singularity at most 1 over r if I expand for small r. And then you just get a formula that this thing right here integrated over the entangling surface is the entanglement entropy. That's it. Okay? So you get a pretty simple explicit expression for the thing that you're supposed to, that gives the entanglement entropy. Okay? So what did we just prove? Okay, what is it that was just proved? What we proved is that for essentially, let me just put this up here, okay? So what we essentially proved is for any quantum field theory in any dimension, okay, when we compute the renormalized gravitational effective action, the Kalin-Wilczek formula gives a sensible definition of the entanglement entropy that is finite, okay? The caveat to this is the argument actually doesn't hold for the fluctuations of gravity itself, and the reason is that this regulator of this cone is not generally covariant when we include fluctuations of gravity. Basically, it's not a solution of the equations of motion unless we put in some brain tension, some small brain tension, and integrate over the brain fields. But then we're essentially putting in a brain with a small tension, and we have additional massless degrees of freedom, okay, in the theory. So it may be that there's something good that happens here, that somehow these decouple, but at least without further analysis, we can't say that this holds for fluctuations of gravity, okay? But other than that, it holds for any quantum field theory in any dimension, for any local terms, arbitrary local terms, so the arbitrary high orders in the derivative expansion. The other major caveat is that it holds only for these states that are defined by a path integral in this rotationally invariant space-time. Okay. Okay. So just to give you a flavor for, I'm doing good in terms of time. So just to give you a flavor for how calculations go in this, it's pretty straightforward to calculate things. So here is our metric again, okay? And this is the deformed metric, which reminds me that it has the deficit angle cut out. Now, if you just go ahead and expand, for example, you calculate the Ricci scalar in this geometry, you get the lowest order thing, and then you get the order epsilon terms. And as promised, it depends on derivatives of beta, okay? But now you can evaluate this at r equals 0 just using the fact that these various functions, well, these functions rho and gamma, have to have certain properties at the origin in order for this metric to be regular. And so these beta primes turn into delta functions, and you know how to evaluate these rows and gammas near the origin. And then, for example, here, you just find that this I1 is just 2. It's just a constant, okay, when you do all of this. And that leads to, that's the translation in our notation for this very standard result that the entanglement entropy is 1/4 times the area. Yeah. That's right. So I just need to integrate by parts. So the delta prime, beta prime is a delta function, but derivatives of delta functions don't scare me, right? They're just, I just integrate them by parts. Okay? Yeah. So you'll get, at higher orders, you'll get, yeah, many more derivatives. You have to integrate by parts a few times, usually. Okay? So the subleading terms, for terms that are polynomials in the Riemann tensor, you can actually show a general result. And these are, so far, what I've shown are all results that are already in the literature, okay, just done here, for example, in this paper, which are done using slightly different methods, but are certainly must agree. So we're just checking that we agree with standard results. So the leading subleading terms are the R squared terms, and there are 3 of them. And you know, you can calculate the contribution to the entanglement entropy. You get some funky derivatives with respect to of these rows and these gammas. Okay. All right. So we did calculate some new results. The previous methods people used were a little bit cumbersome, and I don't know if anybody ever calculated these. But we can calculate, for example, this term. We can calculate it. It gets a little bit cumbersome, so we restricted to the case where this metric was proportional to a sphere metric, and we get, again, some funky result, okay, involving higher derivatives of this rho thing, okay? Now, one thing that's sort of interesting here is that the subleading terms in the entanglement entropy depend on the extrinsic geometry of the entangling surface. So here's our metric again. The intrinsic geometry of the entangling surface is just this metric gamma ij. So this rho parameterizes the extrinsic geometry, okay? And remember, in our setup, the path integral, the extrinsic geometry is what defines the state on the entangling surface, right? Different rows here would define different states on the same entangling surface. And so the fact that all these formulas, these subleading UV divergences depend on rho is telling us that they are, the coefficients of these things is actually state dependent. Okay, that's something that has not really been appreciated in the literature. Okay, so the subleading, and this is actually not something that's surprising in general, because it's very general that subleading UV divergences generically depend on IR scales. So for example, the cosmological constant depends on the, it has a leading divergence, which is just a pure power, but then the subleading divergences, for example, depend on, you know, the mass, for example, of a particle and so on. So in general, I don't think this should be surprising. Okay, so all of this result was pretty formal. It says that, okay, this Kalin-Wilczek formula seems to work. It defines a renormalized entanglement entropy, at least for the class of states where it makes sense. We can, the leading area term agrees with the black hole entropy, the leading term in the black hole entropy. So we can ask whether all the subleading terms, which can also be UV divergent, are they also related to black hole entropy? And the answer is, as far as we know, the answer is yes. So the setting in which we can make this comparison is we imagine we have some theory where we have higher curvature terms in the action, okay? And we can think of these as arising from integrating out some heavy states, like string states or something like that. We assume that the only light modes are the gravitational field. So the low energy theory is Einstein gravity. Then these higher dimensional terms will give some small corrections to even classical black hole thermodynamics. And there's a general, so you have to generalize the entropy in this setting, order by order in these higher derivatives. And this was worked out in a very, very beautiful way by Wald for the sort of idealized case of a perfectly static black hole, which they always have these bifurcate killing horizons. And this is exactly the same, the setting where we have these bifurcate killing horizons is exactly the setup where the Kalin-Wilczek formula holds. So we have two very geometrical constructions of two things called entropy that are defined for exactly the same set of space-times. So even just from that, you would think that they must agree. And physically, it's a test of whether this entanglement entropy matches the black hole entropy. And basically, the status is that we find agreement for all the cases that we have computed, which is not very much. It's really these cases where we have an algebraic function of the Riemann, and that was already known, and it was already known that they agreed here. So we just checked this one additional term, and it matched, so we think that it must just match, right? We're too lazy to do more calculations. You're welcome to do more calculations. There's also a general argument, which I haven't really digested well enough to know whether it's true, but it uses exactly the same ingredients that we're using, and so I haven't had time to go through this. But it may be that there's a general argument in this paper here, which is referenced in our thing. But it appears that the black hole, the Wald entropy, agrees with the entanglement entropy. That's the bottom line. Okay. Okay. So that's sort of it for the technical part of this. So I was going to, you know, do a little bit of speculation about what this might mean physically, if there aren't any questions. Okay, so this is the speculation that I just said before, is all of this structure is very reminiscent of, for example, coupling constant renormalization in field theory or effective field theory, where the reason that it works, the physical reason it works, is not because Weinberg or somebody proved that overlapping divergences cancel, some very technical fact about Feynman diagrams. It works just because it has to work. It's because there is some fundamental theory, or it's possible that there's a fundamental theory, where the objects, the things that we're measuring, are just finite and well-defined. And if that is true, then the UV cutoff just acts as a kind of matching scale, which is arbitrary, and nothing can depend on it. So that's sort of the physical reason why renormalization works. And all of this renormalization structure just suggests that something like this is true in quantum gravity. And if we believe that, since there's really nothing locally that distinguishes a black hole horizon from any other surface, it would seem that the entanglement entropy would be a quarter of the area, I mean, maybe not for any boundary, but for at least a huge class of boundaries, right? So nothing, not limited just to black hole space-time, okay? And it's also then very, very tempting to ask, you know, you might have asked at the very beginning of this thing, you know, why am I even here listening to this talk? We understand black hole entropy, okay? At least string theorists do, because string theorists tell us that, you know, they know how to count, at least in some cases where it's simple enough to do the calculation, they can just count the microstates of a black hole and they get one quarter of the area, okay? So we already understand everything, okay? But I think that that's not an entirely satisfactory. And let me expand on this just a little bit. I've got some extra time, so let me expand on this a little bit. So the answer is supposed to be, we all know the answer, right? The answer is that Okay. So we know the answer, right? We know the answer we're supposed to get. The black hole entropy is one quarter. I'll just keep working in four dimensions because I'm parochial. Okay, this is the answer we're supposed to get. Now, clearly, this Planck scale means the renormalized Planck scale at the low energies at which we're doing measurements, right? So, because this entropy has to do with things like lowering buckets of gas into your black hole and what happens and things like that, right? So, this is a thermodynamic entropy. So, this M Planck squared is a low energy M Planck squared. Imagine we had a theory with lots of massive thresholds between the string scale and the scale at which I'm doing black hole thermodynamics. I integrate out electrons, whatever, all these massive states, okay? Then this thing here will depend on all of those massive states, right, in some complicated way. The more accurately I do it, I have to do loop matching, blah, blah, blah. This has some very non-trivial dependence on all those heavy states. Well, if this formula is right, then this must have exactly that same dependence, okay? But if I'm counting string states, you know, somehow I would like to think, that's what this speculation is saying, I would like to think that what I'm counting, when I'm counting the black hole entropy, there's some UV part where I'm sort of counting string states, and I would like to think that that is should be able to be reinterpreted as a UV contribution to the entanglement entropy. So what I'm suggesting is that somehow the same calculation can be, the state counting interpretation, I'm speculating, could be interpreted as a UV contribution to the entanglement entropy. Then it would be exactly calculating this counter term that we see in the entanglement entropy, okay? So I'm saying that you could combine these things, these two different pictures of what entropy, black hole entropy, means, they could be combined in a very, very nice way if we could understand the string theory state counting as a kind of entanglement entropy. Oh, nobody's yelling at me. Okay, I didn't succeed. I was hoping to get people to yell at me. At Stanford, they yelled at me for both of these things. Okay, anyway, it's okay. So the conclusions are very simple. What I want to claim is that the identification of entanglement entropy with black hole entropy really does work in all the cases that we know. I remember a while ago when I asked Rob Myers what did he think the status of this was, he said it seemed like it was a beautiful idea that was marred by ugly facts. So what I'm claiming is that there are no ugly facts, okay? It just seems to work. We need to understand it. There are lots of open questions. I think one obvious one is, can you include gravity fluctuations in this? It's pretty annoying that the one field, the quantum field that I cannot include is the one that has to be there for this whole story to make any sense. A very important thing is to generalize this. Does this generalize to more general states and entangling surfaces? So even if I'm just restricting the states defined by a path integral, I'd like to be able to get away from this rotational symmetry. And that's very important because this entanglement entropy, although I didn't mention it, it's very important for studies of conformal field theories, and that's actually the main reason I got into this, because I wanted to, the entanglement entropy is used to define, can be used to define C functions in arbitrary dimensions, actually. So it seems like if we ever get a unified theory of C functions, it should have something, might have something to do with entanglement entropy. But unfortunately, these rotationally invariant cases, we cannot treat any interesting cases outside of two dimensions in this framework. So we really need to extend this framework if we're going to talk about conformal field theory. So I didn't succeed in my main motivation, actually. Then also, it might be nice to really understand whether it's there is a general proof that entanglement entropy is Wald entropy. OK, so that's it. Thanks. I don't remember why I had this up there. Yeah.
Who are you in that picture?
What? Actually, I was thinking of using that, of making one of those guys Sorkin. So Sorkin was going to be the guy. This was supposed to be Sorkin. He even looks vaguely like Sorkin. But not. Anyway, I'll leave that up there. Yes?
So this might be what you're alluding to at that very last part. I mean, when you actually calculate this once more to verify things are working, the right-hand side is a skin-dependent Van Planck, and so you have some definition that involves what Van Planck, the normalized Van Planck is. What do you use the left-hand side of
So yeah, I mean, there's a sense in which this is a little bit uncomfortably circular, right? Because I'm using the Kallan-Wilczek formula to define this. Okay. So what I'm saying is I'm grasping the bull by the horns. I'm saying that you don't have a good definition of entanglement entropy. Okay. I'm using you to make you feel, you know, try to intimidate you. And I'm saying that nobody has a good definition. Okay? It's a question of defining it. Okay? And so there is this geometrical candidate definition. So the question is, does it make sense? And the answer is yes, that it makes sense. Of course, like for example, like I said, you could make a different definition of entanglement entropy. You could say, I define it by putting my quantum fields on a lattice. And then you would have a perfectly good cutoff, you know, positive entanglement entropy and so on. It would just have no relationship at all to gravitational physics.
But isn't that sort of interpretation a little more akin to what the actual doing spin theory really comes to space? So is it clear that what let's say if you actually calculate the string theory has anything to do with your way of defining
it? I don't know. We should ask a string theorist. I mean, to me it's not clear at all, but maybe I don't know.
Not you, John. You're not a string theorist. Comment on this?
Is there any chance that the calculations by Kallan et al. And you know and Vaffa and Strominger could be somehow interpreted as an entanglement entropy? Is that possible? I mean, somehow in
because this is the essence of their.
Yeah, but I think that in the state, I would say I would also turn it around to people. I think that, I mean, the state counting thing is great, and that's what, you know, that's the that's what we wanted, right? From the beginning, we just wanted a state counting interpretation. But then you do have to answer the question: why does this renormalization count states? See, that's the part that is still completely open. Why is it that if I have, you know, 15 threshold, the dependence on all these masses, why does that work out here? It has to, right? And so it's not at all, so there's some, you know, so the thing is entanglement entropy sort of automatically gets all that right, but this is mysterious. And in the state counting, it's vice versa, right? You're shaking your head. Do you want to make a comment?
I think you could fix it when you're passing these thresholds. I think you fix the energy or the entropy,
Oh, I'm keeping fixed. Just I'm keeping fixed the UV theory. So I'm fixing some string theory, some compactification.
So you're fixing some given energy, but then of course the Schwarzschild radius will also change when you go through all these thresholds.
You're supposed to be getting this by.
It's really the area that changes together.
But
then obviously you're finding the same states. It's just that the area will change in a way that degrees with Planck scale. So.
Oh no, I don't think so. It's this. It's the coefficient between the area and the entropy that's changing.
The same. So you're saying that
in the string counting you can understand how this depends on the mass of the electron.
Well, we're not at that level yet, but if you're counting some specific states, and we certainly know that remains fixed as you go through the threshold.
So you're just saying
it would remain fixed.
So you're saying you're saying you're confident it will work out in the end. It has to because you're confident the answer is right.
It's fixed, but of course that's related to this other question of how do you define it in a generally covariant way that would react in the right way to crossing all these thresholds. So that's a similar question to that.
Yeah, but it doesn't disturb you that entanglement entropy does that automatically. It's just a coincidence. Just a coincidence. Okay, could be. Yeah.
Quadratic divergence. It's reminiscent of the quadratic divergence of the Higgs mass inside the model, which we know is not to get rid of.
Mm-hmm.
It's called the Higgs mass hierarchy.
Yeah, but here we don't necessarily want to get rid of it. I mean, it's perfectly the most common scenario we have is that indeed the Planck scale is the highest scale in the. And that it makes sense to talk about, and so having something that's quadratically divergent, b of order m Planck squared, is perfect. So it's a hierarchy problem we don't want to solve. Yeah, I mean the detailed coefficient, but I mean there's no hierarchy problem in that we're not trying to explain why it's smaller than it theoretically should be. It's right where it should be theoretically.
Other questions?